Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Baudrin. With me is my co-host, Barry Rose, the dream, the dealer, the tower of power, the man of the hour. Barry Rose, how you doing?
I'm doing great, man. I had a beautiful morning. I sat outside. I listened to the birds chirping. It's about 60 degrees and sunny here. It's always sunny in Philadelphia. So it's a beautiful day, of course.
They should name a TV show that.
You know what? They really should do that. But apparently tomorrow night we're getting more snow. So Monday morning is going to be 2 to 3 inches of snow. It's April and we're still getting snow, Jeff, and it's driving me nuts.
Don't you love living in the Northeast? Okay, so on this show, folks, we're not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We're going to break kayfabe on music, movies, television. We're going to break kayfabe on life. And on today's episode, we're going to talk about two more of the matches that people feel should have been, by God, on my top 100. People telling me what to do, Barry. I don't know if I like that or not. So we're going to talk about two of those matches. And because of the tremendous response that we got on the fast food restaurant deal, we are going to take a look at our top 5 chain restaurants. More food talk. I feel like we're turning into Guy Stinkin' Fieri here. We're going to do some more restaurant talk, top 5 restaurant chains throughout the country. Barry, I know you love talking food about as much as you love talking wrestling.
I think I love talking food even more. I think if we could turn this podcast, which will never happen, but into food and nude scenes for movies, I think I'd be good. I think I'd be all right.
I would like to say that the nude scene episode was also very well received. Seems like everyone has an opinion on food or nudity. I've had a few people ask me to discuss the sex scenes in movies. You know, obviously the deviants on the Facebook page are coming out, Barry. So before we go to our topic today, I want to give a couple shout outs regarding the nudity episode. Sean on Twitter, who's very interactive with me on Twitter. Always appreciate Sean chiming in there, I believe from Manchester, England. Sean had told me that Linda Hamilton, by God, got naked in the Terminator, the first one. He sent me the link. I checked. Barry, she was pretty fantastic looking in that movie. And she dropped trow, as they say. So, Sean, you're right on the nose on that one. Linda Hamilton did look pretty stellar in that one. He also sent me a question, and I'm going to poke the bear with you, Barry, real quick. Didn't tell you about this one, but I'm going to surprise you. Barry, would you pick Phoebe Cates from Fast Times at Ridgemont High or in the movie by Quentin Tarantino From Dusk Till Dawn, if Selma Hayek had dropped the top, who would have been your number one choice?
Oh, man. Well, here's the good news. We have a couple hours, so I can sit here and just discuss this for the next 2 hours. So it's a difficult question, and I'm going to tell you why, because you're either addressing 19-year-old Barry or 39-year-old Barry. So it is two different things. I'm going to say Phoebe Cates, and only because I think my hormones were raging 10 times stronger at 19 than I was at 39. As much as I looked at Salma Hayek, and it really is, that is such an incredible scene, and what a great movie that is, but as 19-year-old Barry sat in the movie theater, and, you know, literally when you're 19, you know, our audience is, you know, about 95% men. We were all 19 at one point, and as I'm sitting in the theater and I'm watching Phoebe Cates get topless on the big screen, you know, there are certain urges I was feeling. So I'm gonna go with Phoebe Cates on that one, but that really is one of the tougher questions you've ever asked.
Okay, I really don't think the listeners want to hear about your urges.
Yeah, I bet. I bet.
So, a couple other things. Want to give a shout-out to Lou Kippelman from the Facebook group. Lou pointing out that Michelle Johnson, who was your number one choice, I believe, Barry, was in fact not married to Chuck Finley, married to Matt Williams, former San Francisco Giants third baseman and I believe Washington Nationals manager up until the last couple years ago. Real quick, because I know this is something that you will have an answer to, Colin Spencer wanted me to ask Barry. Barry, real quick, right off the top of your head, give me your top 3 John Waters films.
Wow. I'll say Polyester, Female Trouble and Desperate Living. But that could also change at any time. But yeah, fantastic. I love the John Waters movies, especially the old ones. And at some point, and I know, Jeff, that you're not a fan of watching Divine movies and so on, but it's such unique kind of gonzo cinema that was, you know, John Waters in his early days. He's a little more slick and refined now than he used to be. But in his early days, in his early films, it was John with a camera, a very, very small crew just on the streets of Baltimore, no permits, just filming wherever they wanted to film. And it's groundbreaking filmmaking for the early 70s, at least in my opinion it was. So at some point, if you do watch some of these movies, and granted, they are not for everybody. I absolutely understand that. I have some fantastic stories which are really centered around a John Waters Film Festival that I saw in late August 1984 in New York City, as well as interacting with certain members of the cast who should have been locked up that night. So I would love to share those stories at some point.
All righty. We'll look forward to that. Okay, so now we're going to go ahead and take a look. And we're going to look at two of our matches, folks. We're going to start off December 30th, 1985, as recommended by Scott Bowden. It's another Lawler match. You'd think that maybe Bowden has a, you know, fixation on Jerry Lawler. What do you think there, Barry? Jerry Lawler, Bill Dundee, Loser Leave Town. I think it was like the third or fourth Loser Leave Town between these two guys. And we're in Memphis, Mid-South Coliseum. Barry, you had a chance to look at it. Tell me what you think.
Yeah, so we watched a match, and we actually talked about it last week, which was Lawler versus Dutch Mantel in the barbed wire match, and I wasn't really a huge fan. I thought it was an okay match. I thought the highlight of that match, which was really the entire match, was the punching, and their punches are incredible, and I'm going to say it in this match as well. The punching is absolutely incredible, but I would say the difference is this, to me, is a fantastic match. This is – so Lawler and Dundee – if you go through professional wrestling history, there are certain people, certain individuals that wrestled each other hundreds, if not thousands of times. And I think immediately coming to mind, who would you say? Would you say the Sheik and Bobo would probably be right at the top? Lawler and Dundee would also be there. Sherry Lee, my good friend Sherry Lee and Bonnie Watson wrestled each other hundreds of times in the state of Florida. But literally, Lawler and Dundee must have worked together hundreds, if not thousands, I'm going to say thousands of times, probably. That being said, these guys put on a match that had everybody standing the entire time. So granted, this audience, it looks like a sellout crowd, so you've probably got 10 or 12,000 in this building. They probably, everybody in that audience has probably seen Lawler and Dundee wrestle hundreds of times. Doesn't matter. They're standing, they believe it, they buy it. And I've said this before, and I'm going to say it again because, A, I like repeating myself, is Memphis Wrestling knew their audience like nobody else did. They knew. And by putting on this match, I was blown away when I watched this. So I think this is one of their better matches. But there's a stipulation here, and it's basically it's for the Southern title. But they really build it up, the importance of this match. And they've got all these guys outside the ring. There's a very young Sting at ringside watching, Jim Hellwig, Ultimate Warriors at ringside. So the match starts off. Lawler comes in the ring, and he's got this bandage over his eye, and it's kind of covering, you know, the majority of his face, actually. And apparently it's from an early altercation with Dutch Mantel and Lance Russell. And Lance is so good here. And Lance is another guy. You know, there's always this debate. Who's the greatest of all time? Is it Gordon Sully? Is it Lance? And look, I'm always going to be a Gordon guy. I was born and raised a Gordon guy. It's not going to change. On the other hand, Lance is perfect for Memphis. You know, I associate Gordon with Florida. Now, not so much with Georgia, but with Florida. And I kind of feel like Memphis and Lance really do go hand in hand. So Lance alludes to the fact that Dundee probably had a hand in Dutch Mantel attacking Lawler and injuring the eye. Dundee takes off like a house of fire immediately, and he's really the aggressor maybe the first half or the first two-thirds of this match. And he is... Dundee is fantastic here. Again, we talked about his punches, and you know, I know there's the great debate about Dundee and his punches that you know, Dundee's worked punches could have broken your jaw, but he, you know, he just looks great in everything that he does. And this match really said something to me. If Dundee had been 6 inches taller, he would have been a national star, because there's not a flaw in his game otherwise. He's short. He's very short. Other than that, this guy is gold. He does everything absolutely perfect. So this is one of his better matches. But the brawl is – they start to brawl. It's and there's so much writing in it. It's awesome watching the crowd and listening to the crowd reactions. And they're brawling. They move up into the stands. And they're punching each other, or it's mostly Dundee punching Lawler, and they're right up along a railing, and Dundee punches Lawler, and he goes flying over the railing onto the ground. And it's got to be, it looks, you know, judging by, it looks like it's probably 8, 9, 10 feet in the air. So it's a hell of a bump to see it. And I won't spoil the ending, Jeff. I'll let you bring it home. But, you know, week after week, we look at some matches. Some are good. I don't think any are ever terrible, but some are good, some are great, and some are really the top echelon. And I got to say, this match is really right at the very, very, very top. It is 15 to 16 minutes, and there is not a slowdown or a break in that 15 or 16 minutes. So really, really exciting stuff. This is one of those that you want to look for on YouTube.
Actually, the match goes 22 minutes and 42 seconds. That's the call that Lance Russell gives at the end of the match. I don't know whether there was some editing done. Just some context.
There always is, sure.
Yeah. Just some context. The stips on the match was loser leave town. If Lawler lost, if Dundee lost, he and his wife Beverly, or she might have been his ex-wife at this point, would had their head shaved, which I think, I believe – there had been another occasion where his wife had her head shaved. So
right.
That's really interesting when you bring your wife's hair into the equation. That's just somehow very twisted, but very compelling. So Lawler comes out. He's bandaged the eye. There's a reference made by Lance that some sort of vial of a mysterious liquid had been thrown into Lawler's eye. Dundee is just being so heelish. Now, this is the Dundee that eventually would become the Dundee that was part of the Bill and Buddy show, which I just think was probably the, dare I say, penultimate, just the quintessential heel Bill Dundee, if there ever was one. And he had a run of a good, I don't know, 4 months or so where he was just so on fire. And he was probably the best heel working anywhere in the world. He was that good. He punches Jerry Calhoun, just calls off and smacks him. And Dundee, as he's knocked Lawler down, he proceeds to start just sort of taunting him and baiting him, you know, take a swing at me, take a swing at me. And Lance is going, because of the injury, Jerry Lawler's depth perception has been affected here. So he can't really see, you know, where Dundee is to punch him. And I thought that was a really effective use of the gimmick and the fact that the angle had been done. And that's what's part of the debilitating Lawler. As you pointed out, Jim Helwig and Steve Borden standing at ringside, as were other guys in the promotion. The bump you described is, geez, what a great bump. he basically throws him over the side of the grandstand. And as you said, we're talking about maybe an 8 to 10 foot drop where Lawler just took a straight bump and it looked like he took it on his side. This wasn't like, yeah, the back bump where the back absorbs everything. He took this on his side and his hip had to be hurting him. But what I loved was that at one point, as he's working on Lawler's eye and Jerry's got some, get some color and he's bleeding all over himself. Coco comes over to the table where Lance is sitting and goes, "Lance, his eye is all cut up. You know, they're going to maybe stop this match. They should think about stopping this match." And Lance with a great quote where he says, "This is war at its worst." And because of the brutality that was being inflicted, you know, from one guy to the next. And the match ends up where Dundee gets the win. Tony Falk, boy, Tony, coming and handing the gimmick to Bill Dundee to help him secure the win. And Jerry Lawler leaves town. And on our friend Scott Bowden's Kentucky Fried Wrestling, they delve more in depth into what happened that resulted in Lawler coming back. So I would certainly recommend that you check out our good friend Scott Bowden's Kentucky Fried Wrestling if you don't already. Look for that recent episode where they talked about the Bill and Buddy angle and how effective it really was. So, but no, you're right, Barry. This is absolutely a top-notch brawl, and again, a very effective use of psychology.
But how genius is this promotion that here's two guys, and when did Dundee come over? 75, 76, 77? So here's two guys that have essentially been wrestling each other for 8 years, and they're still selling out, and the crowd is super into it and super vested. To me, it's so cool to be able to see something like that. And there really are few promotions. I can't really think of another one. Certainly Dusty Rhodes and Kevin Sullivan in the 80s in the state of Florida, the Freebirds and the Von Erichs in the 80s in Texas, but nobody went 7 or 8 years. You know, I mean, I know Dundee and Lawler are still wrestling these today, right? Aren't they still somewhere in whether it's Tennessee or Mississippi? They're still working against each other occasionally, so it's pretty incredible. But this was a fantastic match. This is, I think, one of the best that we've actually shown.
And the really amazing thing about it is, if you think about a program that was up in New York, and they would have, like, even Patterson and Backlund, we talked about last week, they had four matches in the Garden. So they have four matches in the Garden, which means basically, let's just say every 4 weeks, because you're talking about a 3 to 5 week window usually that they would book the Garden. And so Backlund would come back, you know, one time, then the next month they'd come back and again. But Lawler and Dundee are working this angle in the same town every single week.
Yep.
And the fact that they could come back and keep this program fresh with one guy turning on the other one, or they would be a tag team. And they were a great tag team, by the way, when they teamed up. They were some terrific stuff that they had out there as a tag team. I believe that when the Freebirds debuted in Memphis on TV, the team they fought on TV was Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee. And that's a great match. It's out there on YouTube. But no, this is really good stuff. You know, both guys, as you said, and I really love the content, you know, the concept of having the guys come and sit at ringside to indicate how serious this program is. And that, by God, you know, Jerry Lawler is going to leave if he loses this match, and Bill Dundee is now going to lose his hair. His wife is going to get her head shaved in front of everyone. So it was really super compelling stuff. Just really, really good job on the promotion of this match. And yeah, this is one of the better ones we've seen in a long time. Okay, so next we're going to go to Madison Square Garden, the aforementioned Madison Square Garden. I believe this is the first time. No, I correct myself, because we did do a couple. I was going to say the first matches from Madison Square Garden and the Hulk Hogan era. I don't know. Depends era. On your point of view. Yeah, point of view. We are going December 28th, 1984. Jack and Jerry Briscoe versus Adrian Adonis and Dick Murdoch. I got to tell you something right here, Barry. You're talking about, and we're going to discuss this in an episode down the road. These are two of the top tag teams of all time, my friend.
These are, and so these are really four wrestlers that are four of the greats of all time. And as I was watching this, none of this was lost on me. And so, well, I'm going to say it right now. This is one of my favorite matches of all time. And I realize I'm Mr. Positivity, that I generally like a lot of what I see. At the same time, you're talking about, you know, the Briscoe brothers. So you and I grew up with the Briscoes. I watched the Briscoe brothers from 1971 on, from a live standpoint. Dick Murdoch, I saw wrestle hundreds of times. Adrian Adonis, we talked about over the last few episodes. But these are four of the best wrestlers and workers of all time, and four people that I think I saw live hundreds, maybe, you know, it can't be thousands, but hundreds of times. I was blown away by this match too, and we shit all over the WWF. I know that I do. It's not my style of wrestling, and never truly was. At the same time, had I seen this match on an NWA show, I would have just walked away and go, "Holy fuck, that was Adam!" It was mind-blowingly incredible. Why this program didn't continue? And my assumption is that I think this all leads up to Jack walking out of the WWE. And how did the story go? Do you remember the story? Was he at an airport like in Pittsburgh, and it was snowing, and he was like, "You know what? I can't do this anymore." And he just went home, and that was it. He never worked again.
I believe the story was that he told Jerry that he's taking the first plane heading south, and he was sick of the snow, sick of the travel. And he said, "That's it. I'm done. And the first plane that's in this airport that's heading south, I'm getting on it and going home."
So, and what's incredible, and I know we discussed this last week too, we were talking about Jack Briscoe, but so this is one of Jack's last matches, and we're looking at a handful of matches right now, and one of the last matches of Jack's career, and he's still just mind-blowingly good. The Briscoe brothers, I think the big surprise with this match for me was, I didn't remember them being as over as they were. And the fans were 100% behind the Briscoes in this match. They were buying every little move. Anything that, Jack or Jerry was doing, they were completely into. And they were so vested in the end of the match that when they feel that the Briscoes have been cheated out of the title, they start chanting bullshit, which I just thought was great. And I think that was also directed at the referee, and when I'll talk about him in a minute. But this match is one, go out of your way to see it. I would say this is the archetype. This is the blueprint of what a great professional wrestling match should actually look like. And so starting off, Gorilla Monsoon on commentary, and he's kind of, Gorilla's okay here. You know, sometimes I know later years, he kind of became really insufferable for me with a lot of his shtick with Bobby Heenan, which is what he was kind of known for. But, you know, he's got some good insights here. And one of his earlier insights, he says in commentary, he goes, when he's talking about the Briscoe brothers, they had the most beautiful fireman's carry you'll ever want to see. Both of them. I just thought that was just such a unique thing for him to say. Really solid work. And the real standout here, and I got to say, all four men are at the top of their game, but Jesus Christ, is Dick Murdoch on fire in this match or what? And it's his selling. I mean, even from the get-go, he's jawing with the referee. And the referee's up to, like, Dick's, like, waist. I mean, he's a really short ref, and Dick's a big guy. Dick squats down and starts to jaw with the referee, and it's so entertaining. But his selling, his offense, you know, he does the back of the knee off the top rope and drives the guy into the mat, his patented elbow, and then he does his world-famous brainbuster. And his world-famous brainbuster was really made famous by Killer Carl Cox. And I love Cox. You know that, Jeff.
I think we've established that.
Yeah, just a fantastic wrestler, and but to see Murdoch. So, you know, you've got an old fart like me at this point. I'm 54 years old, and I'm sitting here and I'm watching guys that I've watched for the last 40 years. So I see Murdoch do the brain buster, and he does it on Jerry, and I'm popping out of my chair. It's that good. This is that good of a match. And you know, then there's a power slam by Adonis. Did you see that power slam? I never saw a power slam like that. And Adonis is another guy. And you know, unfortunately, you know, the old theory for a lot, especially in wrestling, is that people remember the last thing that you did. So Adonis, he's always remembered for this very grotesque kind of transvestite character and, you know, being 400 pounds. But here, you know, he's big, but boy, he could still go. He's so good. But the referee here was absolutely terrible. And I would have to think, I don't know who this referee was, but I would have to think this was about the end of his WWF career, because I know that he didn't make it into the next generation. But when you watch him, there are a couple of counts here that were easy threes that only come across as twos. And, you know, I've always heard the old adage is that the referee is supposed to count to three. And if he counts to three, the fault is on the wrestler or the boys. It's not on the ref. He's supposed to count to three. So I absolutely, I just, you know, I'm watching this guy and I'm seeing that and I'm going, man, this guy sucks. And the fans are chanting bullshit about that as well. But again, the Briscoes are super over. The match is eventually ruled a no contest, and the match ends with the Briscoes putting both men in the figure fours, and the crowd is just going nuts. And I got to admit, I was going nuts. This is my type of wrestling. This is not a WWF match. This is a Florida match. This is an NWA match. And, you know, hindsight is always going to be 20/20 what ifs and all that bullshit. Could you imagine if we would have had these two teams in the NWA in 1985? I mean, feuding with either the Midnight Express or the Rock and Roll Express or the Four Horsemen, whatever it is, just throwing these four guys in the mix. Unbelievable. Love this match. This is, I got to say, the two matches we saw for this episode, Jeff, it's probably my favorite double since we started doing the podcast. Just, I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, you know,
is that
what?
Enough? Is that enough?
No. I'm gonna tell you what I think. I think that folks, if you're listening, go to YouTube. December 28th, 1984, Madison Square Garden. This is a top 100 match. This is probably even a top. Maybe top 30 match. It's that good. And I think I even like it better than the Lawler Dundee match. That's how good it was, because one of the things I wrote was, this is a match that you could have easily stuck in CWF at any point during the 70s or 80s, because that's how good it was. This was not, you know, not to sound like the Florida wrestling snob here, but this didn't come across like a WWF match. This is not slow paced with a lot of emotional components. These are four guys just working their damn asses off to get over. A couple points. I think it was interesting when they were introduced. Adonis and Murdoch are introduced as the WWF World Tag Team Champions and representing the World Tag Team titles. And I was trying to remember, did they call them the World Tag Team titles or the WWF Tag Team titles?
I don't know. And I can only tell you my point of reference on that would be whenever they came to Florida, not them specifically, but like whenever the WWF came to Florida, I guess it was three W's, they were never referred to as World. Where the NWA was the NWA World Heavyweight title, the WWF was just that. There was no world attached.
And that's reason why I noticed it. And I'm sure, you know, if John McAdam is listening to this, he's going, "Hey, dumbass, I know what the answer," you know. So I'm sure John is probably cursing at the recording right now. A couple other things. Gorilla Monsoon's calling this match by himself, nobody with him. He refers to Jack as a former NCAA champion, which I thought was pretty interesting, giving Jack the credibility. There's a great spot in the very beginning when they're taking off their ring jackets where Murdoch hands his ring jacket to the referee. Jerry takes his ring jacket away and starts stomping on it, which I thought was just hilarious. One thing I noticed about this, and especially compared to the match that we talked about last week with Jack Briscoe versus Roddy Piper. And I know we said that Jack was getting ready to retire, and I'm certainly not impugning Jack Briscoe here, who was one of my heroes of wrestling growing up. Jack with a bit of a gut here. He was heavier than he was during the Piper match. And I wondered if when you watch it, if you get a chance to look at it again, you will see that Jack has a bit of the Dunlop syndrome going on. Certainly was still great shape, but he was a little bit heavy. Adonis was also looking heavier. I also made a note of the interaction between Murdoch and the fans, which was just fantastic when he leans over the ropes and he gets into it. One of the guys at ringside and they're shouting each other back and forth. I will completely agree with you. As great as Adrian Adonis is in this match, as great as Jack Briscoe is in this match, as great as Jerry Briscoe is in this match, the star of this match is Dick Murdoch. Dick Murdoch in this match, you watch this match, and you can see why there are people out there that consider Dick Murdoch a candidate for world championship. Because he is, you know, they say there's nights when he goes out there and decides he wants to be a wrestler, and he's one of the top five guys in the world. And then there's nights he goes out there and decides he wants to be a clown. And that's why they would say, no, we can't trust him with the world title. But he's amazing. He does this bump in this match that just absolutely split me up laughing, where he gets hit, he goes down, he takes the bump, he goes down. And he hits the mat face first and then raises his ass in the air. And he's just in this like frozen position with his ass up in the air. And it's so funny. And then let's see what else. So you refer to Gorilla Monsoon. And I made a notation that in one match, we went from good monsoon to bad monsoon back to good monsoon. All in the course of one match, which lasted, I don't know, 25 minutes or so. But because Good Monsoon was the NCAA champion, talking about all the different background things about the guys, calling the action. And then he starts chastising the referee, which, as you said, probably he deserved it because he wasn't doing a good job. But there was one point where I think someone had like someone in some sort of a wrist lock or something like that. And the guy's back was to the ground and the referee started counting one or something like that. And he's chastising the referee. That is not a pinning combination. Why are you even counting that fall? Because it's not a pinning combination. It's completely ridiculous that you shouldn't even count. And I was just like going, oh, please be, you know, get over yourself a little bit. And so then there's another point where Murdoch hurts his leg. He makes the tag. He goes back to the corner, but he doesn't get outside the ropes. He stays inside the ring, sitting down. And Monsoon is going, I think he has problems with his leg. He can't even get up. And that's why he's still remaining inside the ring. So I did make a notation of who the hell was this referee. He probably called the slowest the slowest count outside of Bronco Lubitsch. He made Bronco Lubitsch look like Tommy Young in this match. The match, you mentioned that the crowd yelling bullshit. So what happens is at the end, all four guys go outside the ring. They're doing a schmoz and a brawl outside. Somebody takes, I'm not even sure which two guys it was, but somebody slams somebody's head into the announcer's table and it knocks over his screen, his video screen, and knocks his microphone off. And it was a great piece. This is where we get back to really good Monsoon. When Monsoon starts going, are we still on the air? Do we have audio? And it was just absolutely tremendous the way that he was calling the finish. And, you know, because there was chaos outside the ring, they go in, they put him in the double figure four. The crowd is going nuts. Really strong. This to me was better. As good as I liked the Lawler Dundee match, this was better. This was a really, really, and I'm not even sure this may have been the best WWF match of the decade. Boom. There I said it.
Yep.
I mean, that's how crazy good this match was. And, you know, 3 months later, Jack Briscoe decided to walk away from the business. And Barry, I know you'll agree, might have been one of the greatest wrestlers of all time, not just for this time frame. And you think about the fact that if Jack had been more of the mindset to keep going, he probably had another good 5 years in him of high quality stuff. But he just got tired of the nonsense, tired of the travel, and just walked away. He's one of those guys that walked away still on top. And there's not a lot of guys in wrestling that do that, you know, outside of someone who has to retire because of an injury. So anyway, two really strong matches. And I hope you guys will avail yourself. We'll post the links to those on the website. Now, before we get to our top five list, a couple other quick mentions. Our good friend Jeff Zinger. If anyone knows about nudity in movies, it's our boy Jeff Zinger, who reached out to me and said, I can't believe you didn't ask me about my top five choices. So Jeff Zinger, Barry, just wanted to throw out three quick ones. His choices were Matilda May from the movie Life Force. You familiar with that one?
Yeah, so he's right about that, too. And so Matilda May, pardon me, I don't know who she was, but there was a movie directed by Tobe Hooper from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And it was 86, I believe, and it's a movie called Life Force that stars Steve Railsback. Anyways, this woman, Matilda May, is an alien from another planet, and she spends the entire movie completely naked, and she is pretty incredible. So I have to give him a lot of credit for that one.
And he also would like to mention Scarlett Johansson in the movie Under the Skin. Have you seen that one?
I have not, so I cannot comment.
All right. So, and third, he throws a bone to Phoebe Cates by giving her the number three position, which is completely outrageous. But I did want to mention my man Zinger. So thanks for the shout out, Zinger. Jamie Ward wanted me to let everybody know that he considers Barry and I the man show of podcasts. So, yeah, I take that as high praise. I like the man show with Adam Carolla and what's the other guy? Did he ever do anything? Jimmy Kimmel. Yeah, that guy. So high praise from Jamie Ward. Appreciate the shout out.
Ziggy Zaggy.
Yep. Yeah, Ziggy Zaggy, Ziggy Zaggy. Oi, oi, oi. So also, Barry, how great was it? Posted on the Breaking Kayfabe sheet or a Facebook page as well as a few other Facebook page. How great was it, the story that I told about Judge Chris Pohl in Broward County, when I told him about our podcast and talking about old school wrestling, when he says, oh, what do you mean? Like guys like the Great Malenko? That really popped me. I got to tell you, that was awesome. So special shout out to Judge Chris Pohl for that. Also want to mention, I was extremely happy by seeing that Owen Hart is making it into the, I believe it's the Tragos Hall of Fame. Owen Hart was one that is when I started getting the Observer, was one of the first guys that I sought out his stuff on tapes. And back in the day, and was one of my favorites back in the day. And we remember Owen, and I'm certainly very happy to see someone of his talent, his ability going into the Hall of Fame. Barry, your thoughts real quick on Owen?
Yeah, so Owen was great too, and there really were two different Owens. I was never overly impressed with his WWF stuff, though. I was there in the Garden for the WrestleMania. I think it was WrestleMania 20 when he wrestled Bret in the Garden, and that was as good a match as you'll ever see. But of course, the restrictions that he would have had in the WWE, and plus a lot of the gimmicks and stuff like that. But you look at his stuff from Calgary, you look at his stuff from Japan. Owen Hart was one of the best workers this business ever saw, without a doubt.
Yeah, an amazing, amazing athlete. So now it's time, Barry, we are going to take a look at our top five best and worst sit-down restaurants. It's food talk again here on Breaking Kayfabe. They're lining up to the table now to listen to our choices, Barry. So why don't you go ahead and give me your number five best sit-down restaurant chain? And we're talking chains here, folks.
We are talking chains, too. And there was somebody actually asked and go, are we talking chains? And you actually clarified that for them yesterday. The beauty of what we do, and I really realized this when we were doing the fast food show, which is, you know, 3 or 4 weeks back, was how regional a lot of this stuff is. And, you know, again, I can be in Chicago or Tampa. We can go to Portillo's, or I can be out in California or out in the West Coast. There's In-N-Out Burger. At the same token, Cookout, which there was a huge post yesterday in the Mothership group. You know, if you're down in Virginia or North Carolina, there's going to be a ton of Cookouts down there, but you'll never get that on the West Coast. So I love the fact that a lot of this is regional. And our boy, Travis Raines, gets a mention every show, brought up this this chain called Sagebrush yesterday as one of the worst, and I had never heard of Sagebrush. So I asked him to tell me what it was, and I went online and I did some research. And I, you know, based off of what I saw, I kind of agree with him. It looks like a shithole. But to that end, somebody else, I think it was Kevin Carter, actually said Sagebrush is disgusting. So it is cool to me that, you know, the beauty of Facebook and the beauty of what we're doing right now is that we do have people, you know, you've mentioned it. We have people in Australia. You know, somebody from Kuwait contacted you a few weeks back. And but the fact that we can talk about this and somebody might say, you know, we've got this great chain or this really shitty chain in Virginia, and we've never heard of it, which is just kind of mind-blowing. So to that point, this is a chain restaurant. We are looking for something that's kind of national, but I love hearing about these obscure little chains. To that end, my number five pick, kind of a nice little segue there, Jeff. My number five pick is a company based out of North Carolina called Firebirds. Have you ever heard of Firebirds?
I've never heard of that. Tell the folks about Firebirds.
I will educate the peeps about this little restaurant company called Firebirds. So some of you know, and certainly if I haven't pointed it out or Jeff hasn't mocked me over the last couple of months, but I did work in the restaurant business. I did everything, and I wound up being a general manager and a managing partner towards the last 10 or 15 years of my career in restaurants. So I spent a lot of time working in restaurants, but also, you know, doing a lot of research and knowledge and things like that, because you always want to find out about competition and what people are doing. So Firebirds is this chain based out of North Carolina, and I was actually hired to work for them prior to me coming to the position I'm in now, which I work for a company called Open Table. So Firebirds would have been my last restaurant position, but I realized I was way too old and my body was way too beat up to do this any longer. So Firebirds is, how can I compare Firebirds? It's kind of, have you ever been to a Redstone Grill?
I have not. Apparently I'm missing out on some of these chains across the country, Barry.
And they may not be, here's the thing, they may not be down in South Florida, so you may not be aware. So Firebirds is a little similar to Redstone Grill. A lot of it is wood-fired. It's on the grill. They do ribs. You can get seafood. It's a little more high-end. You know, entrees can go anywhere, probably 14 to 25, 26 bucks. So it's a little pricier. It's not like a Roadhouse or an Outback or something like that. It's a little more high-end. That being said, the food is really, really good. They do some incredible burgers there. I've gotten this barbecue burger, which is great. And it's not a typical hamburger either. These are gourmet burgers. But the real hook for me here, every time I go to a Firebirds, and we've got two or three in Pennsylvania now. I think we've got three. They do these smoked chicken wings. So they smoke the wing, they deep fry the wing, and then they toss it in their own hot sauce. And I got to admit, it's one of the best wings I've ever had. And I'm definitely a wing guy, so it's one of those, you know, something that I would judge a restaurant on. So I'm a big fan of Firebirds. Had I not come to Open Table, I would probably still be working for them, but they do everything right. Again, it's a little more high end. The service is really good, and they're always busy, which I like too. You can go in, whether it's, you know, 12 o'clock on a Tuesday or 7 o'clock on a Saturday night, whatever it is, Firebirds always has this vibe going and this buzz going. So I'm a big fan.
Okay, my number five. I'm glad you did a relatively regional chain, because that makes me feel less bad, because the one that's my number five choice is a chain here in Florida called Flanagan's. And Flanagan's is they specialize in seafood, ribs, that kind of stuff. My wife and I actually went there last night. Special shout out to Facebook friend and friend of the show, Joey Broussard. Barry, let me tell the listeners what Joey's been through the last 9 months. Joey got picked on a jury. I may have mentioned this. I don't know. He got picked on a jury down here in Fort Lauderdale. The jury was deliberating 8 months. 8 months. And poor Joey just got off that panel. I was able to see him. I actually went there last night. They're known for their ribs. They have a special way of cooking their ribs. I believe they boil the ribs before they put them on the grill, and they're absolutely fantastic. Had a hamburger last night there, and I told my wife, I said, this may have been one of the best burgers I've had at a restaurant in years. That's how good they are. So, yeah, it's a restaurant that was founded by a guy named Joe Flanagan, who big fisherman. They got all the pictures across the wall of going back 30, 40 years of big, you know, catches out in the ocean, sailfish and other huge fish. It's a great place to go to watch a ball game. And my boy Joey always takes care of it. He's the manager of the particular one, the branch that we go to. And it's great because it's right down on Deerfield Beach, which is in the northern part of Fort Lauderdale. And literally you walk across the street and there's a boardwalk where you walk down the ocean, and it's absolutely beautiful. You got the ocean waves, the breeze coming off the ocean, and it's absolutely spectacular. And we love going there. So have you ever been to Flanagan's when you've been down here?
So here's the thing with Flanagan's. So years ago, and I'm going back 40 years ago, Flanagan's was part of the whole Big Daddy's thing. There was,
yes,
like Big Daddy's Flanagan's, and it was less about the food, and it was more of a bar-type atmosphere. And there was one in – so if you've lived in South Florida in the last 40 years, you would know Flanagan's and Big Daddy's. But there was one in North Miami, and it was on Biscayne Boulevard, and we used to go there. This would be in the early 80s. And I remember as a little dipshit, I was 14 or 15 years old, and I'd be standing in line to get into the building with a fake ID, which was a birth certificate, no photo ID, and I looked every bit of 14 years old. I was probably 120 pounds, gigantic afro. I don't think I was even shaving yet. You know, I didn't look like I was 18 years old, but I would be standing there with this birth certificate to go into Big Daddy's to go drinking, which I did. But at the same time, it was really less about the food. It was more about the alcohol consumption. And I think there was a change years ago, because the place that you're describing is actually really, really popular with people who live in that area. So I've never been to that one specifically, but I've been to other locations.
You know what I realized as you were telling that story about bringing your birth certificate to Big Daddy's? You know what you were doing when you were 14 years old, Barry, without even knowing it? You were breaking kayfabe, by God!
I was breaking kayfabe, and I have so many, I was talking, so I'll digress for a moment, because hey, why not? I'm really good at that. But so my son, and everybody knows if you pay attention to either my Facebook page or even this show, my son is in 11th grade, getting ready to go to college in about a year and a half. But he is he's kind of an anomaly, because he's a great student. He's highly intelligent. I don't know where any of this comes from. It doesn't come from his wife. Well, maybe from her, but definitely not from me. But
his wife or your wife?
I guess it would be my wife.
He's not married. Yeah, I don't think Zach's
married. That I'm aware of. Yeah, but so the odd thing about it is he's never had alcohol in his life. He's never tried it. And I've said, Zach, if you want to taste a beer, whatever, he goes, no, I'm not going to do it. So yesterday he says, you know, I'm going to a party tomorrow night and I might try a sip of alcohol. So, you know, I'm like, Zach, just be smart. You're not driving, which is good, but, you know, just be smart about the whole situation. And he's 17 and a half years old. And, you know, in my head, I'm going, geez, by the time I was 17 and a half, I probably had been drunk several hundred times, vomited hundreds of times. I was a terrible kid. And I spent a lot of time at that Big Daddy's in North Miami. So it is true. You know, it was a different world back then. But I used to have this fucking birth certificate that was a phony birth certificate that I would fold up, put it in my wallet, and I would show. And it actually got me into bars. So it's kind of mind-blowing. But he's a completely different kid. And thank God he's a completely different kid, you know?
Yeah, the world doesn't need a second youngster like Barry Rose, apparently. So, okay, number four, Barry.
So number four is a place that I just went to for my son's birthday a couple of months back, and it was Fogo de Chão. So there are several of these high-end Brazilian steakhouses, and the truth is they're all good. You know, some might be better than others, whatever it might be. And one of our listeners, and I forget who it was, and I apologize, but somebody posted about Fogo de Chão. Might have been Steve Peterson. I'm not really sure, but they posted about Fogo and they said Fogo is great. You know, he had his bachelor party there, and he said they have this garden salad bar, but fuck that. We just ate meat, meat, meat. So Fogo de Chão is great, because I know that, you know, you're a fan of the Brazilian Steakhouse.
If I could interrupt you, Barry, absolutely. The guy who mentioned Fogo is Sean MacGyver.
Sean MacGyver.
So screw you, Peterson. You didn't mention it. It was MacGyver, by God.
Steve Peterson was mentioning Cantor's Deli in L.A. There's only two locations, so it doesn't really qualify, but it was Sean MacGyver, and thank you for that as well. So, and he's right, though. So Fogo de Chão is great. Brazilian Steakhouse, you pay one price. I think it's $45 or $50. You go in, and they give you a card table tent, a card, and you flip it over if you want meat. If you don't, you flip it back over. And we were there, and it's in most cases with Brazilian Steakhouse, you're spending a couple of hours. The idea is you want to go slow, but they bring you, I'm going to say, 20 different types of meats, whether it's chicken, whether sometimes it's seafood, there's lamb, there's beef, and then there's all different cuts and different preparations, and they slice it table side. They'll give you as much or as little as you want. Some are better than others, but at the end of the day, it's all seasoned great, and it tastes fucking unbelievable. Where I'm going to disagree with Sean MacGyver, though, is the salad bar. And by calling it a salad bar, it's almost like you're talking about the salad bar at Wendy's. It's not fair. It doesn't do it justice. The salad bar at, and I'm not going to fucking call it a salad bar for that. I'm going to call it a garden bar, which is, I think, what Ruby Tuesday calls theirs, which still isn't correct. But in any case, this garden bar doesn't just have salads. Oh, and it's got salads, and it's got great salads. You've never eaten a salad, Jeffrey Wayne Baldrin, if I'm correct.
That would be right, sir.
Exactly. However, and I love salad. I try to eat salad every day because I love it. But they also have a charcuterie up there. So they've got all these sliced meats like capicola and soppressata, all these like Italian or Brazilian types of meats, and some are spicy. Then they've got all these different types of peppers that are just incredible tasting. But for me, I'm a huge fruit guy. They've got fresh sliced pineapple, and then they've got three or four different types of citrus fruits sliced, no peel, no skin, just the actual fruit. And they've got blood oranges. And when I saw that, I stopped eating the meat and I started eating like all this citrus fruit. So I'm a huge fan of Fogo de Chão. The other aspect of what they do is the staff is friendly and knowledgeable, but it's some of the best service I've ever had in a restaurant. Your plate, if your plate is dirty, if you're done and you want to get a new plate, somebody will stop by and take it every 2 minutes. Like, there's just, they don't have, unlike a lot of the restaurants, it isn't where you've got a traditional server. You're going to have a team of servers. So you're going to have several different individuals, meaning that they've got a whole section. You may have five or six people overlooking a whole section of tables, so anybody can take care of anything that you need, whether it's new silverware, clearing a plate, getting you a new plate, it doesn't matter. And then management is really on top of things. Management as well, floating around, you need something, you want something removed, whatever it is. Then they'll actually say to you, do you want to have a specific cut of meat stop by the table? I can get that for you. Like, this is, we're talking top of the line service. So my experience at Fogo de Chão was great. I, you know, if there's any question legitimately as how I've gained 11 pounds in the last year, it's by going to places like Fogo de Chão. But honestly, I can't say enough good about the concept.
I've actually been to a Fogo de Chão in Atlanta. My daughter took my wife and I there. Last year, there is a place here in Broward County in Fort Lauderdale called Shima, not to be confused with Chima, as my wife calls it, that is very similar. And it's really, really good stuff. I agree. And whether it's a salad bar or the garden bar, it's good. My God, it's just completely overwhelming how big it is and the amount of food that they offer at the salad bar. So, yeah, that's pretty incredible. So, okay, my number four, Barry. We are sticking with more nationally known chains. Fogo de Chão, I don't know if that's like at the national exposure that a place like my number four does. My number four, I want to give a shout out to Randy Miller on the Facebook page, who also mentioned Carrabba's. And I'll tell you what I like about Carrabba's. First of all, we have a waitress there that we go there, and she knows us, so she always is very nice to us and really takes care of us. Barry, I'm talking about the spicy chicken soup, which is just off the charts good. It's probably the best soup of any restaurant I've ever been in. And we literally will go just to get the spicy chicken soup. I end up getting some, and then I get a bowl to go. I got lunch at work for the next day or two. It's absolutely amazing. The rest of the menu, they have I get their scampi Damien, which is a shrimp scampi. That's really, really good. Their chicken parm is, I would say, good. I don't know if I'd say it was great, but the scampi Damien is usually always off the charts. And the one thing I will say they do not do well, in my opinion, because my wife has ordered a few times, pizza. You don't want to order pizza there. And my wife has ordered pizza. You know, they bring the individual pizzas, and it just kind of looks like a hot mess, quite honestly. But no, the spicy chicken soup is reason enough to go to Carrabba's. Barry, have you been there?
I have been at Carrabba's, and Jeff, this is where I say this is my number five on my bottom five chain of restaurants. Yes, sir. So quickly, let me quantify this and explain this as well. So a lot of these Carrabba's, some are run by the company, and I guess others are franchised out. I forget exactly.
You're absolutely right. And a lot of times you will have one that's really good, and you go across town, and it's a complete crapple. So, yeah, that's absolutely very fair point.
Yeah. So, and to that end, I have had great experiences at Carrabba's. I will say, I think there's been a slight shift over the last decade in Carrabba's. But if you would have asked this question, the one that we're asking today, if you would have asked me this 12, 14, 15 years ago, Carrabba's probably would have been in one of my top five chain restaurants, and now it's bottom five. And a lot of that has to do with, I think they did franchise a lot out, and the standards have dropped. So there's a Carrabba's near me. It's probably, from driving standpoint, it's within 5 miles. And I haven't been in probably 3 years was my last experience. And I'll tell you about my last experience. and this is why. And I should say as well, they used to have a chicken dish there. It was chicken and goat cheese and like a lemon butter sauce. And I forget what it was called, but it was great. I used to actually crave that dish. It was fantastic. And this goat cheese was, I guess, an Italian version of goat cheese, but it was just delicious. But so we went to this Carrabba's, and they had, each one has a managing partner. And a managing partner is essentially the GM, but it's somebody that is financially vested in the restaurant. They get points, meaning that if she hits sales, if she keeps her labor in check, if she's hitting her food cost, she's going to get a huge bonus. So it's to her benefit that she's running a really, really good ship. Well, I don't think she really gave a shit about that, because she wasn't running a good ship. And we had a horrible experience. And this is really the capper. So my son got a soup, and I think it might have been the same soup. Is it the one that has the meatballs in it? Jeff, does that ring a bell?
You know, to be honest with you, the spicy chicken soup is the only soup that I've ever had there.
Okay. So they have a soup that's got meatballs, and maybe it's a pasta fagioli or something like that. I don't know. But anyway, so the soup came, and it was ice cold. And and I don't just mean it was just a little, it was lukewarm. I mean it was cold. And it said to me that where they store the soup, that, you know, the lighters went on, that something wasn't working. So we sent the soup back. So the soup came back, and it was really hot, but it had this strange kind of bubbling foam on the top of it, like somebody had hocked a loogie in my son's soup.
That's nice.
To that end, I don't believe that somebody did. I think it was maybe just heated up in a microwave, and it boiled, and it was all foamy. We discarded the soup. We didn't eat. The rest of the food came out. It was mediocre at best. It was lukewarm, like nothing was hot. The pasta was cold. And I don't think we went on a busy night. It wasn't like Saturday at 7 o'clock at the height of insanity. I want to say it was like a Tuesday. To that end, I think I called the manager over, and I think I said, like, I got to admit, you know, I've eaten here before. I've had okay experiences, but this one was really, really bad. And she said, well, you know, if you try us on another night, we could be a lot better. And that was basically how her attempt at resolving the situation. So I paid the check, and I said, you know what? I'm never going to go back to that fucking restaurant again. And to my credit, I haven't. That being said, if I went to a Carrabba's 30 miles away, I could probably have a good experience. Unfortunately, I was kind of tainted by the experience here. And that is the first time I've said the word taint in this episode as well. So,
well, we certainly appreciate that. No, that's absolutely correct. You know, there are different chain restaurants where you can go to one. And I think we have other ones like that too, where, you know, this is the good Carrabba's, and the one, you know, 4 or 5 miles down the road is the crappy Carrabba's that we don't go to for, you know, and for whatever reason, like you said, maybe it's a part of the corporate structure. Maybe it's one of those ones that's owned by a certain individual, and it can make all the difference in the world. You're absolutely right.
It really does.
So, okay. Barry, I guess you are up to your number three.
I am up to my number three. It's going by quick too. So mine is and Jeff, you're going to be familiar with this one. It's a restaurant called Houston's. So Houston's, and you are familiar with Houston's?
I do know Houston's.
Yeah, you do have them down in South Florida. So Houston's is really, really interesting, and I can tell you how I discovered Houston's. So when they were opening up a Houston's on 53rd and 3rd in New York City, and my wife and I were living at the time, it's probably like 1998, maybe 97, we were living at an apartment on 52nd and 3rd. So we were a block away, and this new restaurant, Houston's, was coming, and neither of us were really familiar with it. Well, for an entire week, you could go to the restaurant for lunch or dinner and get anything off their menu, and it was only $5. So if you know Houston's, it's expensive. It's not cheap. My favorite crab cake in the entire world comes from Houston's. They do these crab cakes, and it's literally crab meat, almost no filler, browned, and it comes with this Dijon Pommeray sauce. Regardless, we literally had lunch and dinner for a week at fucking Houston's on 53rd and 3rd for $5 an entree. And we were hooked right then and there. And then it was the first restaurant I ever took my son when he was born. And Houston's is kind of dark, you know, it's kind of got a little bit of a mood. And he was in his car seat, and we would just put him in the, in one of the big, very oversized booths. But I'm such a huge fan of what they do, and it really set the standard. And I hear the owner is an extremely difficult person to work for, not a fun guy. He's very militaristic in the way that he runs his restaurants. The servers make a great, great, great living working there. But I think the shelf life for a server is somewhere between 9 months and a year, because they're so militaristic and so strict with what they do that I think a lot of the joy is taking out of working in a restaurant. Houston's switched names for the majority of their restaurants about 5 or 10 years ago, and they became Hillstones. And you can still find Houston's. There are Hillstones out there. Certain cities, and I think Fort Lauderdale and Miami is one of them, where there's actually a Houston's and a Hillstones. And in New York, it's the same thing. And the reason for that, as bizarre as this may sound, is that there was a law enacted years ago that if a chain restaurant had more than 20 locations, they had to list their calorie counts. And Houston said, you know, fuck that. I'm going to circumvent this law, and I'm going to change the name, and I'm only going to keep like 19 Houstons, so I don't have to do that. And they did it. And it didn't hurt their sales, which is even kind of more amazing. So I'm a huge fan of what they do. Again, it's not cheap. The ribs are great. The meat products are great. My wife, who is conscious about what she eats, gets their veggie burger, and she'll say it's the best veggie burger she's ever had, and it probably is. I fucking hate veggie burgers. You know, to me, it's not a burger. You can call it whatever you want, but it's not. But at the same time, Houston's, from a sentimental standpoint, being with my son and a baby, one of my favorite restaurants.
So I have a quick trivia question for you. Barry, tell me what song from the 1970s actually referenced an incident that happened at 53rd and a 3rd.
Oh, shit.
I'm catching you completely unaware on this, by the way.
And yeah,
when you mentioned where it was, I went, oh, I know that address from that song. The Rod Stewart song, Killing of Georgie, talks about an incident where someone is killed in the song, and the incident happens at 53rd and a 3rd. Boom! There's my Rod Stewart trivia for the day. Now, let me just ask you a quick question, not about Houston's or anything else, but I happen to see a post today on Facebook by my friend Scott Dickinson. Do you know Scott?
I do know Scott, yes.
And Scott posted about the fact that he is someone who tips servers 20% because, quote, they make crappy wage. So let me ask you, Barry, you've been in the industry for quite a while. You've worked as a server, I believe. Tell me if you think that every person that works as a waitress or waiter should get 20% no matter what.
So when you say no matter what do you mean when you
well,
say no matter
here, what? Well, here's why, and I'll tell you what my thinking is. You know what? If someone gives me good service, I have absolutely no problem going above 20%. If someone takes care of me, I will totally hook them up on the tip because I feel like they've made it worth my while. They've gone out of their way to provide extra good service, and I don't mind giving them 30% and more if they've done especially good service. But if someone gives me completely crappy service, I don't feel like I'm obligated to give that person 20%. I won't be one of those assholes that won't give them anything. But you know what? If you give me lousy service, you're going to get, maybe 15 or below. What do you think? Yeah, so I'm just curious.
Oh, absolutely, too. So with Scott, are we basically saying that if he gets fantastic service, he's never going to raise the gratuity at all? Is that what
I don't know, because
saying?
it was like a meme that he posted, you know.
Okay. No, I disagree with that, too. So if I get really horrific service in a restaurant, and I don't mean the kind of service that the waitress is swamped and it's not her fault. That's the manager's fault for giving her too many tables. But at the same time, if I get a waitress that gives me shitty service because she's either got an attitude or she is on her phone. I've watched waiters sit on their phone when I'm waiting to fucking order and I'm hungry. Then I will show that in the compensation. To the same token, I was in Pittsburgh for 2 days this week, and I went to Quaker Steak and Lube, which did not make my list, by the way. And it's basically, it's a wing place, cheesesteak. It's kind of a sports bar atmosphere. And the food is what the food is. You know, it's you go in knowing exactly what you're going to get. That being said, the service was out of this world. We had a waitress that was a career waitress. She was an older woman, maybe in her 40s. She told us she's got 3 or 4 kids. She works in the days as a shift leader for McDonald's and then comes to Quaker Steak and Lube. So my son, who loves chicken wings, and it was his first time here, was kind of running her a bit. And I was kind of trying to tell him, like, dude, don't do that. Order everything that you want in one shot. To her credit, she never lost her smile. She instigated conversations with us. And she was a super, super pleasant person. And here's somebody that if anybody maybe deserved to be a little bit bitter or jaded, because the restaurant business will suck every fucking last drop of life out of you and turn you evil, this woman was super pleasant. I gave her a 40% tip. And not because I'm the super generous, nice guy. It's because she earned it. I felt she deserved it. At the same token, you know, I was at a restaurant with my wife in New York City. This is going back a few years, and we ordered a bottle of wine. I'm not a big drinker, at least no longer, but we ordered a bottle of wine, and it was a $45, $50 bottle of wine, which is, you know, a little more pricey than, you know, because really I'm not a wine guy. So we're sitting at a table near the bar. The waiter goes to the bar to get the bottle of wine. He's 4 feet from us, and he engages the bartender, who was really hot, in a conversation for 10 minutes while he's holding our bottle of wine. He's 4 fucking feet from us. He could have turned around, put the bottle, gave it, and gone back and flirted with her. Instead, I kind of felt like he was rubbing it in our face. I did show it my tip. I have no problem telling you.
No, and
to that end, yeah.
Go ahead. No, I was going to say, woman that you talk about, the waitress that was working, you know, the old Donna Summer song, she was working hard for the money. You know, absolutely. I have no problem going above and beyond that 20%. But the guy that you talked about that was stiffing you with the wine so he could make time with the bartender. Yeah, that's the guy that deserves to get, you know, a little reminder that maybe his service needs to be upgraded a little bit, you know?
Absolutely. And you're 100% right. It's a reminder. And unfortunately, look, I was a server before I went into management. You even knew me when I was a server going back 25, 30 years ago. And, you know, it's a hard business to the fact that nobody really wants to be a food server. It's something that you do until the next step. And granted, this woman was a career server, and either she had accepted that and had this fantastic attitude or just has a fantastic attitude in general. These are the kind of people that you actually want serving you.
Absolutely. Okay. Now, Barry, time for my number 3. I went real quick and scanned the old Facebook page up until right now, and no one had mentioned this particular chain, Cracker Barrel. Barry, best cornbread and biscuits anywhere. In my opinion, Cracker Barrel has the best. The food, good. I don't know if it's great, but my God, the cornbread and the biscuits bring me into Cracker Barrel whenever I get a chance.
I'm a huge fan of Cracker Barrel. So when I was doing my list, so it didn't make And I got to say, so my I did a top 10 and a bottom 10. And I got to say, my bottom was like a bottom 20, actually. I hate a lot more chain restaurants than I like them. But Cracker Barrel made my top 10. And why did Cracker Barrel make my top 10? The cornbread's good. Cracker Barrel is consistent, you know, and that is the idea. You can get off of any interstate in the U.S., and there's going to be a Cracker Barrel there. It's, you know, whether it's I-95 or it's the Turnpike, whatever, there's going to be a Cracker Barrel there. And they're always strategically placed so that when you do get off, if you don't want McDonald's, if you don't want Burger King, you can actually go somewhere and maybe upgrade a little bit. So I will tell you, Cracker Barrel, you know, again, I don't think I'm going to sit here and say it's the best meal I've ever had, but I've gone in for breakfast. Hey, they do these wild Maine blueberry pancakes. Have you ever had these?
I have not. I've had breakfast here, but I've never had the blueberry pancakes.
So I love pancakes. I love waffles, French toast. I'm a huge carb for breakfast guy. So they do these wild Maine blueberry pancakes, and they're fresh. They're fresh. They're not frozen blueberries, and they burst out of the pancake. So when you go to bite it, you could actually burn your tongue. They're like these like little balls of fire almost, but they're phenomenal. But you give me those pancakes, a cup of coffee, and you know that game they got on the table, which is the triangle with the pegs?
Yes.
I'm fucking addicted, right? I'm addicted to this game, and I can't seem to get past like the same level. I'm all the time. I always leave like four pegs, but I like Cracker Barrel.
I will say that particular game caused maybe more than one or two arguments between my son and daughter as they competed quite competitively on that game.
That's so awesome. Exactly. Yeah. I think my kids, too, have argued. I think I've argued with my kids over that game. Give me that game back. You know? Yeah. And then I always like going in the store after. But Cracker Barrel is great. And it's and I think part of it, there's a consistency to it, which I like. There's, you know, I'm sure there's good and bad. But the service is also, because you are getting people that are probably career servers, you know, when you get into a Cracker Barrel. And I do find, if they're not always the most efficient, they're generally pretty friendly at a Cracker Barrel, and I always appreciate that.
You know, one thing that they do that I really I like as a customer there is the waitress or the serving staff, they have the stars on their uniform indicating how long they've worked there. And, you know, I kind of like that. Like, you know, if you're getting a newbie that maybe is going to have a little more problem, or if you're getting someone that's been there, you know, 3 or 4 years, you know, you're getting a really experienced server.
Yeah, you definitely, you're absolutely 100% right about that too. And I like the fact that they have the country store out front, which to me is very smart marketing, that if you try something that you like, you can go and you can, you know, whether it's some of their preserves, which they do a really nice job with actually, and I always put the same preserves on my cornbread, but you can buy a jar of that, and then you can buy like Christmas music from Burl Ives if you want on CD, you know, whatever it is.
Who doesn't want that? Yeah. Have a holly jolly Christmas. All right, Barry, what's your number two?
So my number two is Bonefish Grill. And Bonefish is, it was one of those that I'm going, okay, is it one, two, or three for me? And what I like about Bonefish is that, A, so there are other seafood chains that are out there. And I'll never, and I'm going to, we'll talk about that shortly, because I'm going to, before I give you my number one, I'm going to tell you the restaurants I truly despise. And, but there are seafood chains that are out there that are of almost the same price point as Bonefish. Bonefish might be a dollar or two more per entree, but that's it. And from a quality standpoint, it's like night and day. I mean, you know, Bonefish to me, it's consistent. The seafood is good. The seafood is safe. One of the things about seafood that scares me is if you're going to get some form of bacterial, food poisoning, a lot of times it comes from seafood, you know, it frightens me. You know, we lived in New York City for years. So many restaurants would do 50% off sushi on Sunday nights. And there was a reason they were doing it on a Sunday night, because that was the end of the shelf life for that seafood. Hopefully it already hadn't gone bad. So Bonefish is a really, really safe alternative. I feel the service is good. Their price point is on, and it's a little more upscale. You know, it's not like going into a lesser chain and having this kind of mediocre experience. So one of the things we always do every year is, and a lot of restaurants do this. Firebirds that I mentioned, we also do it for them. But around the Christmas holidays, you can buy gift cards for restaurants, and if you spend $100, they give you an additional $20. And we usually somewhere in December will go and buy $300 in gift cards, and then get this additional $60. And sometimes it's even more. Sometimes they actually give you like 25 if you spend for 100. So it's kind of a good deal. And you know, and Bonefish has got, there's a couple of things I always get. They do this this corn and crab chowder. Have you ever been to a Bonefish, Jeff?
You know, I actually haven't. I know my brother-in-law really likes the place. He goes there fairly regularly. So I've heard good reports about it, though.
Yeah, they're owned by the Outback family, which is interesting, because it's not, to me, it's not an Outback by any means, but it's consistent. Again, I feel like I can go to a Bonefish here or a Bonefish in Tampa where they're based out of, and it's going to be almost identical. But they do several things, and they, you can get, I don't know if you eat a lot of seafood, but you can get several different types of fish or shrimp or scallops, and they'll wood grill it, and then they'll top it with different types of sauces, and you can pick your own sauce. And I like that also. So I am a big fish. I'm a big fan of Bonefish.
Yeah. I just looked on the page, and I don't see anyone mentioning Bonefish Grill.
Nope.
So that's kind of interesting. So, okay. Time for my number two. My number two is a place that, first of all, great Italian food, but another one of these restaurants where I go for one particular thing, and that is the Italian bread at Maggiano's, which is absolutely amazingly fresh. And, you know, the way that I don't know if they bake it a certain way or what, but holy crap, we go there just to get some Italian bread and try to sneak it out of there. And they have a tremendous offer where if you go there, if you order, there's like about maybe 5 to 10 things on the menu. And if you order from that particular group, they'll let you take home. Like for example, lasagna. If you order lasagna, you can get a thing of lasagna to go home. And I'm talking about, Barry, they give you a friggin' big portion, and it's not dinner. It's definitely lunch for the next day. But the Italian bread is just off the charts good. Have you ever been to Maggiano's?
I have. So I'll give you a little bit of context. So for my last pure restaurant job, I worked for a company called Brio Tuscan Grill. It's the Brio Bravo restaurant group. They have Brio and Bravo restaurants all throughout the nation. I think there's close to like 200 stores now. And our biggest competition was Maggiano's. And Maggiano's had us by a couple of things. We can always debate food and service, which I'll certainly touch on, but they also had these really ornate banquet halls in all of their restaurants, and that's really where they had us beat, that if you wanted to do a large party of, say, 60 or 75 or 100, and I think they had banquet space for up to like 300, they truly had us beat. That being said, Maggiano's does do a good job, and I haven't eaten at one in a while, but I can tell you I was always impressed by three things with Maggiano's. One, the level of service was better than you get in a standard chain restaurant. The staff truly seemed to have a knowledge and an understanding of the product that they were selling, and they were also friendly, fast, and efficient, which to me are the three keys for service, what I want. The second aspect was the food was good. You know, their red sauce was one of the better red sauces I've ever had in a chain restaurant, and it actually beat the Brio red sauce, I thought. So when we were opening up our Brio in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, we used to go to Maggiano's for lunch all the time as we were waiting for our restaurant to open. And I would sit there and go, wow, this red sauce is really good. And I don't know if it was homemade, but I got to say it tasted homemade. And that's really the important thing. So Maggiano's, I think, does deserve to be on a list. And there's something to be said. I know I've gone a couple of times for dinner, and you're seated by a guy in a tuxedo, and it's supposed to be it's Maggiano's Little Italy. So it's supposed to have this Little Italy vibe, which I think is so cool. Have you ever been to Little Italy in New York City, Jeff?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a lot of, you know, you can walk up and down Mulberry Street, and there's going to be people at the doorway that'll try to talk to you to come in their restaurant. But a lot of times it's a guy in a tuxedo and he wants to get you in his restaurant. You know, you've got 50 choices and he's going to try to tell you why you want to go into his restaurant. So I always felt that was a cool touch. And a couple people mentioned this, on our Facebook page as well, that, you know, if there was a special holiday, whether it's a birthday or an anniversary, Maggiano's kind of goes the distance in recognizing that. And I have to agree, because I want to say we spent a birthday for a relative here, and they really do. They really, it isn't the standard, I'm going to bring a piece of cake with a candle and two other servers and we'll sing happy birthday. It was kind of like, you know, they came over with a birthday card that the entire staff had signed. So they kind of go the distance. They go a little above. And I'm a fan as well. I could see it.
Yeah, like you say, it's kind of like for a chain restaurant, it's like they kind of make it appear like you're going a little bit upscale. You know, the tablecloths are cloth, you know, and the napkins are cloth. It's a nice place. Okay, Barry, so I believe we have come to that point in the show where it is time for your number one best sit-down chain restaurant. Before you do, why don't you run through your worst five real quick?
Absolutely. So I'm a guy, when you're in the restaurant business, you learn to eat standing next to a bathroom, in the kitchen, you eat as you're walking, you eat, it doesn't matter. So when I lived in New York, you know, I lived in New York for almost 20 years, I would eat at food carts. I wasn't particular about where I ate. If it tasted good, I'm in. So it struck me, you know, and this is something I've been aware of the last few years. I've never eaten at a Bob Evans or an Applebee's. And I think I've eaten at every restaurant chain available, not something that's regional that I may have never been around. But, you know, this is a national chain. And with Applebee's at some point, I realize both are shitholes, though somebody actually said Bob Evans is okay, but I've heard horrific stories about Applebee's for years. And at some point I said, you know, I should try it. And then I said, you know, fuck that. If I've never been, I'm going to stay with this. So I'm never going to go to an Applebee's or Bob Evans at this point. Just because I'm not really, you know, and I realize the meal would be what the meal is, but at the same time, I'm just not going to go. So my bottom list is I've got five on my list, and I'm going to try to run through them quickly with as little notes as possible.
You already gave us one of yours. You said Carrabba's is in your bottom five, right?
Yeah. So P.F. Chang's would have been number six. I'm sorry, you're right. P.F. Chang's would have been number six. And P.F. Chang's is sad to me, only in the fact that if you would have asked me 10 years ago, I would have said P.F. Chang's is in my top five for favorite chain restaurants. But they've had a real shift in their culture and their food, and I won't eat there anymore because the food really sucks. And that isn't based off a location either. That's just from a company standpoint. My number four worst is Chili's. My issue with Chili's, everything tastes exactly the same. Every time I go, and I haven't been in a few years, but whether I'm going to order fajitas or a burger, it all tastes the same. They load up with like the sodium product, and everything just tastes identical regardless of what you're ordering. Number three, Buffalo Wild Wings. You do one fucking thing, you should get that right. If your name is Buffalo Wild Wings, you should be able to do chicken wings correctly. I make chicken wings in the house. My son, who is a chicken wing aficionado, says I make the best. I have to be honest with you. It's the easiest thing on the face of the earth to make. You take some flour, you season the flour, you roll the chicken wings in there, you fry them in a very, very high temperature in vegetable oil, and then you create a sauce. Well, Buffalo Wild Wings apparently can't get that right. So, you know what? You suck, you know, in my opinion. Number two is Olive Garden. If you like Olive Garden, I cut you a pass if you live in the middle of nowhere and there's no other restaurants. And I realize, too, that, you know, you and I both live in very, very large cities, but we have some people that may live in small little towns, and they may have just a Bob Evans or an Olive Garden. However, if you have other restaurants available to you and you're choosing Olive Garden and you like Olive Garden, get the fuck out of here, because it is the worst excuse for food, in my opinion. Take out the salad and the breadsticks, which everybody says, and they are damn good, the salad and the breadsticks. The chicken is disgusting. It is rubbery airline chicken. It's the same type of chicken that you used to get when you used to fly and they would give you a chicken dish. You can't cut it. It's a piece of rubber. The sauce comes out of a bag and it's frozen, and then it's heated up in water. Their food sucks and it's terrible. And I hate, sometimes I tend to read one of my...
I'm just laughing because this is not your number one.
Wait till I get to number one, Jeff. But one of my hobbies is to read newspapers, and I read newspapers from all across the country. I do it electronically, of course. And every food column, they say, vote for your favorite Italian restaurant. And every fucking newspaper across the country, people vote Olive Garden. Oh, my God. Yes, my number one, Jeff, let's get to it. I seethe if they make me angry. They are, it's the biggest scam going. It's Red Lobster. It's a shithole. It is frozen, horrific seafood. The last time I ate in a Red Lobster, and I generally eat in a Red Lobster every 5 to 10 years because I'm sucked in by one of their commercials because they do a great job as far as their advertising in the commercials. And then I get there, and then I remember exactly why it's every 5 or 10 years. The seafood has a taste of ammonia. So it's just about going bad, or it's already gone bad. It smells like ammonia. That means the seafood is turning. How do they try to counteract that? They douse it all in a heavy butter and oil sauce with some sort of spice to it. Red Lobster is a shithole. They have somehow been feeding the nation as the number one seafood chain for the last 40 years. You can go to Bonefish Grill. It is 50 to 100 times better, and your check is going to be almost identical at the end. So I can't figure it out. I hate Red Lobster with a passion. I have friends that have worked for Red Lobster that have told me horrific horror stories. That being said, I'm going to Red Lobster in the next few months. And do you know why, Jeff?
Because of the biscuits?
Well, so yes, in a sense. Everybody will tell you they do these cheddar biscuits at Red Lobster. Well, they announced last week they are going to do a version of chicken and waffles. However, they're going to tweak it a bit. The waffle is going to be made out of the same mixture that they use for the cheddar biscuits. They are replacing the chicken with a deep-fried lobster tail. I said, you know what? I'm going to go. So call me a hypocrite. I hate Red Lobster. They make me sick, but I'll be going in the next few months.
All right. So now you've given us your top five worst. Give us your number one sit-down chain restaurant that you enjoy most.
Absolutely. And just a quick shout-out to six concepts that I like a lot that did not make my list. Redstone Grill, Capital Grill, Roy's Hawaiian, Bahama Breeze, Red Robin, and Cheesecake Factory. I do like all six. But my number one, Jeff, is going to surprise you because it is based out of where you live. It is based out of your hometown, just like Bruce Springsteen. This is your hometown, Jeff. It's based out of Lauderdale, and it's Anthony's Coal Fired Pizza. And I know you know Anthony's.
I do indeed.
So why is Anthony's my number one? Anthony's is one of my favorite restaurants. I don't like chain restaurants for the most part. There are so many great restaurants out there where the food is good. You're not being raped when it comes to your wallet and your pocketbook. But Anthony's, I like to go to Anthony's. And I went for a period with my wife for almost a year every Saturday night. We still go every other week if we don't go every week. And there's an Anthony's probably within 10 minutes of us. There's about 70 stores national, but Anthony's is coal-fired pizza. And it's not your traditional pizza. It is a gourmet type of pizza. It's put into a coal oven. The crust is charred. It's a little blackened. No two pizzas ever look alike or ever taste alike, but every pizza I have ever gotten from Anthony's, I have loved. And I generally either go plain, and they always put fresh basil on top for me, or I go the pepperoni because it's hand-cut pepperoni. It's not in a slicer, and I really like that. That being said, their meatballs are great. They also do chicken wings, and their chicken wings, they're not traditional chicken wings. They are chicken wings that are put into the coal-fired oven, so they come out crispy. They're delicious. They're not doused in hot sauce. But you're just tasting the chicken. Their salads, I know you're not a salad guy, their salad, and this was a huge revelation for me. So I make a lot of salads in the house. I eat a lot of salads. We were in Tampa in October, Jeff, and I got a salad at one of the restaurants we went to when we went to the Columbia that one night. And I think a lot of us did. They have a house salad. So I love salads. Their salad is one of the best salads I've ever had, and it's literally lettuce, some gorgonzola, some onion, some celery, chickpeas, and then it's a vinegar dressing. It's basic, it's plain, but it's the freshness of the ingredients that work. And the truth is, it's the freshness of everything that Anthony's does that works. The reason Anthony's makes my number one is something that you and I have talked about this episode, which is consistency. I can go to an Anthony's 20 minutes from me, or 5 minutes, or I can go to one in Fort Lauderdale, and every single time the food is going to be great and it's going to be identical. And that is the key to success, in my opinion, is consistency. I love Anthony's. I can't say enough about it. I have passed up going out to high-end restaurants so I could go to Anthony's because I crave what they do. Jeff, what do you think about Anthony's?
Well, you know, there's some places you go to dine and there's some places you go to eat. And Anthony's is a place you go to eat. And I'm glad you mentioned their meatballs and their chicken wings, because you literally can go to the restaurant and get an order of just I think they give you 2 or 4 meatballs. They have a sauce. They have just a big clump of the ricotta cheese. And yes, their meatballs are absolutely amazing. And the chicken wings, like you said, they're different from anybody else's chicken wings. They come with they're grilled, and they have the onions on them too. And I'm not a huge onion guy, but whatever flavoring the onion is attached on it is really, really good stuff. The pizzas, my wife doesn't like the dark, the extra done pizza. I love extra done pizza. So, you know, I got to tell you, when you told me that, I was like, holy shit, that's one that should have been on my top five, because it easily could have been, because it's that good. So, okay, Barry, now it is time for me to give my top choice, my favorite restaurant. But before I do, I'm going to go through my top five worst. And much like you, I will hope for some brevity here so we don't go too long. Number 5, Olive Garden. Completely agree with you there, Bear. Breadsticks and not much else. That's what I got to say. You know, I've mentioned in a couple of these places that I enjoyed, there are reasons where I go to certain places. You know, I talked about, I go to Carrabba's for the spicy chicken soup. Okay. The breadsticks at Olive Garden are really good. They're not enough to get me in there. I'm sorry. As much as I love the breadsticks, if my wife goes there with my kids, I'll say, yeah, bring me home a couple breadsticks, because I really don't want to go there. Number 4, Red Lobster. Boy, you're totally spot on. The reason to go to Red Lobster used to be those biscuits that were so awesome. Guess what, folks? In your local grocery store and or Walmart, you can now find Red Lobster biscuits in a box in the baking section. And my wife now makes the Red Lobster biscuits, and they're just as good as in the restaurant. Number 3, you also mentioned, Barry, Applebee's. Can't remember the last time I went to Applebee's and had a good meal that I walked out of there going, holy crap, that was really good. You know, I mentioned Flanagan's as one of my top 5. Last night I walked out of Flanagan's, I had a hamburger, and I went, that's probably one of the best hamburgers I've had in I don't know how long. I've never had that experience at Applebee's. Complete shithole. Number 2, IHOP. IHOP, and my number 1 is Denny's. I'm going to mention them together because Denny's and IHOP, you know, one of the things I watch Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, and I know a lot of people don't like Guy Fieri. He's a very polarizing figure in the restaurant industry. But one of the things that Guy Fieri got me to start doing was get away from certain chain restaurants and go out there and find the mom-and-pop restaurants, the individually owned, people that are trying to make a go of it, you know, on their own as opposed to going to a chain. And so my wife and I, we make a point out of going, if we want to go out and have a breakfast this morning, we went to a place called Metro Diner, which is a very small chain. There's only like about 4 or 5 of them that are based. It started out in Jacksonville. And it's so much better than going to an IHOP or Denny's. And I absolutely refuse to go to one of those when I know there is a local diner that's owned probably by some guy that lives locally that's trying to make a go out of it, that's going to be better and probably a better price than stinking Denny's or IHOP. Can't stand either one of them. Thank you very much. Now, before I get to my number 1, I'll mention a couple that when I did my original list that I did, and I'll throw out good or bad. Okay. Chili's used to be good. No good anymore. They still got good nachos and sauce. So Longhorn, like the Wild West shrimp at Longhorn, not bad. Outback completely fell off the cliff about 5 or 10 years ago. You go into Outback's now, there's kind of a weird smell and I don't like it. Next, On the Border. My daughter loves the restaurant On the Border, which is a chain that does Mexican food. TGI Fridays, used to like them, don't like them anymore. Buca di Beppo, it's an Italian joint. There's a lot of different locations. It's kind of a haul because they serve family style. So you're basically going to walk out of there, you know, unbuttoning a few buttons. Hooters. I got friends that like Hooters. That wings, not bad. Let's see. J. Alexander's, much like the place you described, Barry, a little bit upscale, sort of like a little bit like Maggiano's. It's more of an upscale chain. They have some good food there. Now, on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, one of these 3 a.m. and I want someplace to eat. Now, I know I just mentioned Denny's and IHOP that I hate, but come on, 3 a.m., you want something to eat because you're in the middle of nursing a hangover, Waffle House. Come on, folks. Waffle House is awesome. So, but my favorite number, and I believe our boy Travis Rain said it on the Facebook page, that the trashier the Waffle House is, the better the food is. So my number one choice for chain restaurant, Cheesecake Factory. I'm taking one for the team here, Barry, because my wife, by God, if I say, where do you want to go, honey? Your choice. And it's the anniversary. It's a birthday. By God, she's going to want to go to Cheesecake Factory because she loves Cheesecake Factory. I got to tell you something that people don't know. And they got a menu that's, how long is their menu? 40 pages? It just seems like they have the world's largest menu. Here's something that a lot of people don't know. If you like gumbo, holy crap, they serve a good gumbo. You got the Andaline sausage. You got the chicken. Just tremendous. I get it over the white rice. Don't like a lot of the tomatoes, so I ask them to kind of cut back a little bit on the tomatoes. But that's what I get when I go to Cheesecake Factory, and I'm never disappointed in their gumbo, I got to tell you. So that being said, Barry, you think we just about wrapped it up here?
I think we have. This was definitely enlightening too. And I agree with you on the Cheesecake Factory. I like the Cheesecake Factory. There again, there is a consistency to it that I don't think I've ever had a bad meal. I've had some service that's been spotty, but I think from a food standpoint, I think it's you know what you're going to get when you go to Cheesecake, and it's usually a good experience. It's a beautiful restaurant too.
Yeah, no, and they're all over the place, and like you said, they're pretty consistent with their food preparation. Surprisingly, one of the things I don't do, I don't eat cheesecake, love Cheesecake Factory. I'm very particular with my foods, apparently, Barry. So I will just mention now that Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. You can follow me on Twitter, Bowdrin Jeff. I really like some of the social interaction I'm having with some of the folks, like Sean from Manchester, England, on Twitter. So I would encourage you to follow me on Twitter. Love talking with folks there. As I said, Breaking Kayfabe and the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Until next time, folks, tell us what your favorite restaurants are.